It wasn't far to Money Trap Lane. It was in a ghetto of what Lord Rust would probably call skilled artisans, the people too low down the social scale to be movers and shakers, but slightly too high to be easily moved or shook. The sanders and polishers, generally. The people who hadn't got very much, but were proud even of that. There were little clues. Shiny house numbers, for a start. And on the walls of houses that were effectively just one long continuous row, after centuries of building and in-building, very careful boundaries in the paint where people had brushed up to the very border of their property and not a gnat's blink to each side. Carrot always said it showed the people were the kind who instinctively realised that civilization was based on a shared respect for ownership. Angua thought they were just tight little bastards who'd sell you the time of day. Carrot walked noiselessly down the alley beside the sweet shop. There was a rough wooden staircase going up to the first floor. He pointed silently to the midden below it. It seemed to consist almost entirely of bottles. "Big drinker?" Angua mouthed. Carrot shook his head. She crouched down and looked at the labels, but her nose was already giving her a hint. Dibbler's homeopathic shampoo. Mere and Stingbat's herbal wash, with herbs. Rinse and run scalp tonic, with extra herbs. There were others. Herbs, she thought. Chuck a handful of weeds in the pot and you've got herbs. Carrot was starting up the stairs when she put her hand on his shoulder. There was another smell. It was the one that drove through all the other scents of the streets like a spear. It was one that a werewolf's nose is particularly attuned to. He nodded and went carefully to the door. Then he pointed down. There was a stain under the gap. Carrot drew his sword and kicked the door open. Daceyville Slopes hadn't taken his condition lightly. Bottles of all shapes and colours occupied most flat surfaces, giving testimony to the alchemist's art and humanity's optimism. The suds of his latest experiment were still in a bowl on the table, and his body on the floor had a towel around his neck. The watchman looked down at it. Snowy had cleaned, washed, and gone. "I think we can say life is extinct," said Carrot. "Yuck," said Angua. She grabbed the open shampoo bottle and sniffed deeply. The sickly scent of marinated herbs assailed her sinuses, but anything was better than the sharp, beguiling smell of blood. "I wonder where his head is at," said Carrot, in a determinedly matter-of-fact voice. "Oh, it's rolled over there. What's the horrible smell?" "This," Angua flourished the shampoo. $4 a bottle, it says. Shit. Angua took another deep sniff at the herbal goo to drown out the call of the wolf. "Doesn't look as if they stole anything," said Carrot, "unless they were very neat. What's the matter?" "Don't ask." She managed to get a window open and sucked down great draughts of comparatively fresh air, while Carrot went through the corpse's pockets. "You can't tell if there's a clove around, can you?" he said. "Carrot, please, this is a room with blood all over the floor. Have you any idea?" "Excuse me." She rushed out and down the steps. The alley had the generic smell of all alleys everywhere, overlaid on the basic, all-embracing smell of the city. But at least it didn't make your hair grow and your teeth try to lengthen. She leaned against the wall and fought for control. Shampoo! She could have saved Snowy a hell of a lot of money with just one careful bite. Then he'd know all about a really bad hair day. Carrot came down a couple of minutes later, locking the door behind him. "Are you feeling better?" "A bit." "There was something else," said Carrot, looking thoughtful. "I think he wrote a note before he died, but it's all rather odd." He waved in the air what looked like a cheap notepad. "This needs careful looking at." He shook his head. "Poor old Snowy." "He was a killer." "Yes, but that's a nasty way to die." "Decapitation? With a very sharp sword, by the look of it. I can think of worse." "Yes, but I can't help thinking that if only the chap had better hair or had found the right shampoo at an early age, he'd have led a different life."
"Well, at least he won't have to worry about dandruff any more."
"That was a little tasteless."
"Sorry, but you know how blood makes me tense."
"Your hair always looks amazing," said Carrot, changing the subject, with Angua thought unusual tact. "I don't know what you use, but it's a shame he never tried it."
"I doubt he went to the right shop," said Angua. "It says, for a glossy coat, on the bottles I usually buy."
"What's the matter?" "Can you smell smoke?" said Carrot. "Carrot, it's going to be 5 minutes before I can smell anything, except..." But he was staring past her at the big red glow in the sky.
Vimes coughed, and then coughed some more, and eventually opened his streaming eyes in the confident expectation of seeing his own lungs in front of him.
"Glass of water, Mr. Vimes?"
Vimes peered through the tears at the shifting shape of Fred Colon.
"Thanks, Fred. What's the horrible burning smell?"
"It's you, sir."
Vimes was sitting on a low wall outside the wreck of the embassy. Cool air washed around him. He felt like underdone beef. The heat was radiating off him.
"You was passed on for a while there, sir," said Sergeant Colon, helpfully. "But everyone saw you swing in that window, sir, and you threw that woman out for detritus to catch. That'll be a feather in your cap and no mistake, sir. I bet the raghead, Clatchians'll be giving you the Order of the Camel or something for this night's work, sir."
Colon beamed, bursting with pride by association.
"A feather in my cap," murmured Vimes.
He undid his helmet and, with a certain amount of exhausted delight, saw that every single plume had been burnt to a stub. He blinked slowly.
"What about the man, Fred? Did he get out?"
"What man?"
"There was..."
Vimes blinked again. Various parts of his body, aware that he hadn't been taking calls, were ringing in to complain.
"There had been some man."
Vimes had landed on a bed or something, and there was a woman clutching at him, and he had smashed out at what was left of the window, seen the big, broad, and above all strong arms of detritus down below, and had thrown her out as politely as the circumstances allowed. Then the man from the roof had come out of the smoke again, carrying another figure over his shoulder, screaming something at him, and beckoned him to follow, and then the floor had given way.
"There were two other people in there," he said, coughing again.
"They didn't get out the front way, then," said Colon.
"How did I get out?" said Vimes.
"Oh, Dorful was stamping on the fire below, sir. Very handy, a ceramic constable. You landed right on him, so of course he stopped what he was doing and brought you out. It's going to be handshakes and buns all round in the morning, sir."
There weren't any right now, Vimes noted. There were still plenty of people around, carrying bundles, putting out small fires, arguing with one another. But there was a big hole where the congratulating the hero of the hour should have been.
"Oh, everyone's always a bit preoccupied after something like this, sir," said Colon, as if reading his thoughts.
"I think I'll have a nice cold bath," said Vimes to the world in general, "and then some sleep. Sybil's got some wonderful ointment for burns. Oh, hello, you two."
"We saw the fire," Carrot began running up. "Is it all over?"
"Mr. Vimes saved the day," said Sergeant Colon excitedly. "Just went straight in and saved everyone, in the finest tradition of the watch."
"Fred," said Vimes wearily.
"Yes, sir."
"Fred, the finest tradition of the watch, is having a quiet smoke somewhere out of the wind at 3 a.m. Let's not get carried away, eh?" Colon looked crestfallen.
"Well,"
he began. Vimes staggered to his feet and patted his sergeant on the back.
"Oh, all right, it's a tradition," he conceded. "You can do the next one, Fred. And now..." He steadied himself as he stood up. "I'm going down to the yard to write my report."
"You're covered in ash and you're swaying," said Carrot. "I should just get on home, sir."
"Oh, no," said Vimes. "Got to do the paperwork. Anyone know the time?"
"Bingly, bingly, bingly, beep,"
said a cheerful voice from his pocket.
"Damn,"
said Vimes, but it was too late.
"It is,"
said the voice, which had the squeaky, friendly quality that begs to be strangled.
"About nine-ish."
"Nine-ish?"
"Yep. Nine-ish. Precisely about nine-ish."
Vimes rolled his eyes.
"Precisely about nine-ish," he said, pulling a small box out of his pocket and opening the lid.
The demon inside gave him an angry look.
"Yesterday you said,"
it said,
"that if I, and I quote, didn't stop all that 8:56 and 6 seconds precisely business, I would be looking at a hammer from below. And when I said, Mr. Insert Name Here, that this would invalidate my warranty, you said that I could take my warranty and shove..."
"I thought you'd lost that thing," said Carrot.
"Ha!"
said the disorganiser.
"Really? You thought he did? I don't call putting something in your trouser pockets just before they go into the wash losing it."
"That was an accident," muttered Vimes.
Oh, and dropping me in the dragon's feeding bowl. That was accidental too, was it?"
The demon mumbled to itself for a moment and then said,
"Anyway, do you want to know your appointments for this evening?"
Vimes looked at the smouldering wreckage of the embassy.
"Do tell," he said.
"You don't have any,"
said the demon sulkily.
You haven't told me any.
You see, said Vimes, that's what drives me livid. Why should I have to tell you? Why didn't you tell me, eight-ish, break up riot at mundane meals and stop detritus shooting people, eh?
You didn't tell me to tell you.
I didn't know. And that's how real life works. How can I tell you to warn me about things that no one knows are going to happen? If you were any good, that'd be your job.
He writes in the manual, said the demon nastily. Did you know that, everybody? He writes in the manual.
Well, of course, I make notes.
He's actually sneakily trying to keep his diary in the manual so his wife won't find out he's never bothered to learn how to use me, said the demon.
What about the Vimes manual, then? Snapped Vimes. I notice you've never bothered to learn how to use me. The demon hesitated.
Humans come with a manual, it said.
It'd be a damn good idea, said Vimes.
True, murmured Angua.
It could say things like, Chapter 1, Bingley, Bingley, Beep, and other damn fool things to spring on people at 6 in the morning, said Vimes, his eyes wild. And troubleshooting. My owner keeps trying to drop me in the privy. What am I doing wrong? And
Carrot patted him gently on the back.
I should sign off now, sir, he said gently. It's been a busy few days.
Vimes rubbed his forehead.
I dare say I could do with the rest, he said. Come on, there's nothing more to see here. Let's go home.
I thought you said you weren't going, Carrot began, but Vimes's mind was already scolding him.
I meant the yard, of course, he said. I'll go home afterwards.
A ball of lamplight floated through the Ramkin library, drifting across the shelves of huge leather-bound books. Many of them had never been read, Sybil knew.
Various ancestors had simply ordered them from the engravers and put them on the shelves because a library was something you had to have, don't you know? Like a stable yard and a servant's wing and some ghastly landscaping mistake created by Bloody Stupid Johnson. Although in the latter case her grandfather had shot the man before he could do any real damage. She held the lamp higher. Ramkins looked down their noses at her from their frames through the brown varnish of the centuries. Portraits were another thing that had been collected out of unregarded habit. Most of them were men. They were invariably in armour and always on horseback, and every single one of them had fought the sworn enemies of Ankh Morpork. In recent times this had been quite difficult, and her grandfather, for example, had to lead an expedition all the way to Hawanderland in order to find some sworn enemies, although there was an adequate supply and a lot of swearing by the time he left. Earlier, of course, it had been a lot easier. Ramkin regiments had fought the city's enemies all over the Stow Plains and had inflicted heroic casualties, quite often on people in the opposing armies. It is a long-cherished tradition among a certain type of military thinker that huge casualties are the main thing. If they're on the other side, then this is a valuable bonus. There were a few women among the sitters, none of them holding anything heavier than a glove or a small pet dragon. Their job had largely been to roll bandages and await the return of their husbands with, she liked to think, resolution and fortitude and a general hope that said husbands would return with as many of their bits as possible. The point was, though, that they never thought about it. There was a war and off they went. If there wasn't a war, they looked for one. They didn't even use words like duty. It was all built in, at bone level. She sighed. It was all so difficult these days, and Lady Sybil came from a class that was not used to difficulty, or at least the kind that couldn't be sorted out by shouting at a servant. 500 years ago, one of her ancestors had cut off a Clachian's head in battle and had brought it home on a pole, and no one thought any the worse of him, given what the Clachians would have cut off if they'd caught him. That seemed straightforward. You fought them, they fought you. Everyone knew the rules, and if you got your head cut off, you jolly well didn't blub about it afterwards. Certainly things were better now, but they were just more difficult. And of course some of those antique husbands were away for months or years at a time, and for them wives and families were pretty much like the library and stable yard and the Johnson exploding pagoda. You got them sorted out and then didn't think much about it. At least Sam was home every day. Well, most days. Every night, anyway. Well, part of most nights, certainly. At least they ate meals together. Well, most meals. Well, at least they made a start on most meals. Well, at least
She knew he was never very far away, just somewhere where he was trying to do too much and run too fast and people were trying to kill him. All in all, she considered she was jolly lucky.
Vimes stared at Carrot, who was standing in front of his desk. "So, what does all that add up to?" he said. "The man we know didn't get the prince is dead. The man who probably did is dead. Someone tried very clumsily to make it look as if Ossie was paid by the Clatchians. Okay, I can see why someone might want to do that. That's what Fred calls politics. They get Snowy to do the real business, and he helps poor dumb Ossie, who's there to take the fall, and then the watch proves that Ossie was in the pay of the Clatchians, and that's another reason for fighting. And Snowy just slopes off, only someone cured his dandruff for him." "After he'd written something, sir," said Carrot. "Ah, yes." Vimes looked at the notepad retrieved from Snowy's room. It was a crude affair, the wads of mismatched bits of scrap that the engravers sold off cheaply. He sniffed at it. "Soap on the edges," he said. "His new shampoo," said Carrot. "First time he'd used it." "How do you know?" "We looked at all the bottles on the heap, sir." "Hmm. Looks like fresh blood here at the spine where they're stitched together."
"His, sir," said Angua.
Vimes nodded. You never argued with Angua about blood. "But none of the actual pages have blood on them," said Vimes, "which is a bit odd. Messy business, decapitation. People tend to, spray. So the top page has been taken away, sir," said Carrot, grinning and nodding. "But that's not the funny part, sir. See if you can guess, sir." Vimes glared at him and then moved the lamp closer. "Very faint impression of writing on the top page," he muttered. "Can't make it out."
"We can't either, sir. We know he wrote in pencil, sir. There was one on the table."
"Very faint traces," said Vimes. "Blokes like Snowy write as though they're chipping stone." He flicked the notebook. "Someone tore out not just the page he'd written on, but several below it as well." "Clever, eh, sir? Everyone knows you can read the suspicious note by looking at the marks on the page below," said Vimes. He tossed the book on the table again. "Hmm. There's a message there, yes."
"Perhaps he was blackmailing whoever's behind all this," said Angua.
"That's not his style," said Vimes. "No, what I meant was..." There was a knock on the door, and Fred Colon entered.
"Brung ye a mug of coffee," he said, "and there's a bunch of Clatchians to see ye downstairs, Mr. Vimes. Probably come to give you a medal and gabble at you in their lingo. And if you're on for late supper, Mrs. Gorriff's doing goat and rice and foreign gravy."
"I suppose I'd better go down and see them," said Vimes, "but I haven't even had time for a wash."
"That's evidence of your heroic endeavours," said Colon stoutly.
"Oh, all right."
Unease began about halfway down the stairs. Vimes had never run into a group of citizens wishing to give him a medal, and so he did not have a lot of experience on this score, but the group waiting for him in a tight cluster near the sergeant's desk did not look like a committee of welcome. They were Clatchian. At least they were wearing foreign-looking clothes, and one or two of them had caught more sun than you generally got in Ankh-Morpork. The feeling crept over Vimes that Clatch was a very big place in which his city and the whole of the Stow Plains would be lost, and so there must be room in it for all kinds of peoples, including this short chap in the red fez, who was practically vibrating with indignation.
"Are you the man Vimes?" the enfezed one demanded. "Well, I'm Commander Vimes. We demand the release of the Gorriff family, and we won't take any excuses."
Vimes blinked. "Release?
You have locked them up and confiscated their shop."
Vimes stared at the man, and then he looked across the room at Sergeant Detritus.
"Where did you put the family, Sergeant?"
Detritus saluted.
"In the cell, sir."
"Aha," said the man in the fez. "You admit it."
"Excuse me, who are you?" said Vimes, blinking with tiredness.
"I don't have to tell you, and you can't beat it out of me," said the man, sticking out his chest.
"Oh, thank you for telling me," said Vimes. "I do hate wasted effort."
"Oh, hello, Mr. Wazir," said Carrot, appearing behind Vimes. "Did you get the note about that book?" There was one of those silences that happen when everyone has to reprogram their faces. Then Vimes said,
"What?"
"Mr. Wazir sells books in Widdy Street," said Carrot.
only I asked him for some books on Klatch, you see, and one of the ones he gave me was The Perfumed Allotment, or The Garden of Delights, and I didn't mind because the Klatchians invented gardens, sir, so I thought it might be a very useful cultural insight. Get inside the Klatchian mind, as it were. Only it, well, it wasn't about gardening. He started to blush.
Yes, yes, all right. Bring it back if you like, said Mr. Wazir, looking a little derailed.
I just thought you ought to know, in case you hadn't, in case you sold, well, it could shock the impressionable, you know, a book like that.
Yes, fine.
Corporal Angua was so shocked she couldn't stop laughing, Carrot went on.
I will have your money sent round directly, said Wazir.
His expression turned vengeful again. He glared at Vimes.
Books are unimportant at this time. We demand you release my countrymen now.
Detritus, why the hell did you put them in the cells? Said Vimes wearily.
What else we got, sir? They're not locked in and they got clean blankets.
There's your explanation, said Vimes. They're our guests.
In the cells, said Wazir, relishing the word.
They're free to go whenever they like, said Vimes.
I'm sure they are now, said Wazir,
contriving to indicate that only his arrival had prevented officially sanctioned bloodshed.
You can be sure the patrician will hear about this.
He hears about everything else, said Vimes, but if they leave here, who is going to protect them?
We are their fellow countrymen.
How? Wazir almost stood to attention.
By force of arms, if necessary.
Oh, good, said Vimes. Then there'll be two mobs.
Bingley, 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 beep.
Damn, Vimes slapped at his pocket. I don't want to know. I haven't got any appointments.
You have one at 11 p.m. The Rat's Chamber at the Palace,
said the disorganiser. Don't be stupid.
Please yourself.
And shut up.
I was just trying to help.
Shut up. Vimes turned back to the Klatchian bookseller. Mr. Wazir, if Gorif wants to leave with you, we won't stop him.
Aha! You may well try.
Vimes told himself that there was no reason at all why a Klatchian couldn't be a pompous little troublemaker, but he felt uneasy about it, like a man edging along the side of a very deep crevasse.
Sergeant Colon?
Yes, sir.
See to this, will you?
Yes, sir.
Diplomatically.
Right, sir.
Colon tapped the side of his nose.
Is this politics, sir? Just go and fetch the Gorif family and they can...
Vimes waved a hand vaguely.
They can do whatever they like.
He turned and walked up the stairs.
Someone has to protect my people's rights,
shouted Wazir. They heard Vimes stop halfway up the stairs. The board creaked under his weight for a second. Then he continued upwards and several of the watchmen started breathing again. Vimes shut his office door behind him. Politics. He sat down and scrabbled through the papers. It was much easier to think about crime. Give him a good, honest crime any time. He tried to shut out the outside world. Somebody had beheaded Snowy Slopes. That was a fact. You couldn't put it down to a shaving accident or unreasonably strong shampoo. And Snowy had attempted to shoot the prince. And so had Ozzy. But Ozzy only thought he was an assassin. Everyone else thought he was a weird little twerp who was as impressionable as wet clay. A lovely idea, though. You used a real murderer, a nice, quiet professional, and then you had, Vimes smiled grimly, someone else to take the fall. And if he hadn't taken a less metaphorical fall, the poor twisted little sod would have believed he was the murderer. And the watch was supposed to believe it was a Klatchian plot. Sand in their sandals. The nerve of it. Did they think he was stupid? He wished Fred had carefully swept up the sand, because he was damn well going to find out who'd put it there, and they were going to eat it. Someone wanted Vimes to chase Klatchians. The man on the burning roof, did he fit in? Did he have to fit in? What could Vimes recall? A man in a robe, his face hidden, and a voice of a man not just used to giving commands, Vimes was used to giving commands, but also used to having commands obeyed, whereas a member of the watch treated orders as suggestions. But some things didn't have to fit. That was where clues let you down. And the damn notebook. That was the oddest thing yet. So someone had carefully ripped out several pages after Snowy had written whatever he'd written. Someone bright enough to know the trick of looking at the pages underneath for faint impressions. so why not pinch the whole pad? It was all too complicated. But somewhere was the one thing that would make it simple, that would turn it all into sense. He flung down his pencil and wrenched open the door to the stairs. "What the hell's all this noise?" he yelled. Sergeant Colan was halfway up the stairs. "It was Mr. Goriff and Mr. Wazir having a bit of what you might call an argy-bargy, sir. Someone set fire to someone else's country 200 years ago, Carrot says." "What? Just now? It's all clatchy into me, sir. Anyway, Wazir's gone off with his nose in a sling." "Wazir comes from Smail, you see," said Carrot, "and Mr. Goriff comes from El Harib, and the two countries only stopped fighting 10 years ago. Religious differences."
"Run out of weapons," said Vimes.
"Ran out of rocks, sir. They ran out of weapons last century."
Vimes shook his head. "That always chews me up," he said. "People killing one another just because their gods have squabbled."
"Oh, they've got the same god, sir. Apparently it's over a word in their holy book, sir. The El Haribians say it translates as God, and the Smailis say it's man."
"How can you mix them up?"
"Well, there's only one tiny dot difference in the scripture, see, and some people reckon it's only a bit of fly dirt in any case."
"Centuries of war because a fly crapped in the wrong place."
"It could have been worse," said Carrot. "If it had been slightly to the left, the word would have been licorice."
Vimes shook his head. Carrot was good at picking up this sort of thing, and I know how to ask for vindaloo, he thought. And it turns out that's just a Clatchian word meaning mouth-scalding gristle for macho foreign idiots.
"I wish we understood more about Clatch," he said.
Sergeant Colon tapped the side of his nose conspiratorially.
"Know the enemy, eh, sir?" he said.
"Oh, I know the enemy," said Vimes. "It's Clatchians I want to find out about."
"Commander Vimes?" The watchman looked round. Vimes narrowed his eyes.
"You're one of Rust's men, aren't you?"
The young man saluted.
"Lieutenant Hornet, sir."
He hesitated.
His lordship has sent me to ask you if you and your senior officers would be so good as to come to the palace at your convenience, sir."
"Really? Those were his words?"
The lieutenant decided that honesty was the only policy.
"In fact," he said, "get Vimes and his mob up here right now, sir."
"Oh, he did he?" said Vimes.
"Bingley, bingley, bingley, beep,"
said a small triumphant voice from his pocket.
"The time is 11 p.m. precisely."
The door opened before Nobby knocked, and a small stout woman glared out at him.
"Yes, I am," she snapped.
Nobby stood with his hand still raised.
"Are you Mrs. Cake?" he said.
"Yes, but I don't hold with doing it except for money."
Nobby's hand did not move.
You can tell the future, right?" said Nobby.
They stared at one another. Then Mrs. Cake thumped her own ear a couple of times and blinked.
"Drat! Left my precognition on again."
Her gaze unfocused for a moment as she replayed the recent conversation in the privacy of her head.
"I think we're sorted out," she said.
She looked at Nobby and sniffed.
"You'd better come in. Mind the carpet, it's just been washed. And I can only give you 10 minutes, 'cause I've got cabbage boiling."
She led Corporal Nobbs into her tiny front room. A lot of it was occupied by a round table covered with a green cloth. There was a crystal ball on the table, not very well covered by a pink-knitted lady in a crinoline dress. Mrs. Cake motioned Nobby to sit down. He obediently did so. A smell of cabbage drifted through the room.
"A bloke in the pub told me about you," Nobby mumbled. "Said you do, mediuming."
"Would you care to tell me your problem?" said Mrs. Cake.
She looked at Nobby again, and in a state of certainty that had nothing to do with precognition and everything to do with observation, added,
"That is, which of your problems do you want to know about?"
Nobby coughed.
it's a bit, you know, intimate, like affairs of the heart sort of thing."
"Are women involved?"
said Mrs. Cake cautiously.
I hope so. What else is there?"
Mrs. Cake visibly relaxed.
"I just want to know if I'm going to meet any,"
Nobby went on.
"I see."
Mrs. Cake gave a kind of facial shrug. It wasn't up to her to tell people how to waste their money.
"Well, there's the tenpenny future, that's what you see. Then there's the $10 future, that's what you get. $10? That's more than a week's pay. I'd better take the 10-penny one.
A very wise choice, said Mrs. Cake. Give me your paw.
Hand, said Nobby.
That's what I said.
Mrs. Cake examined Nobby's outstretched palm while taking care not to touch it.
Are you going to moan and roll your eyes and stuff? Said Nobby, a man out to get his 10-pennyworth.
I don't have to take cheek, said Mrs. Cake, without looking up. That sort of...
She peered closer, and then gave Nobby a sharp look.
Have you been playing with this hand?
Pardon?
Mrs. Cake whipped the crinoline lady off the crystal and glared into the depths. After a while, she shook her head.
I don't know, I'm sure. Oh, well...
She cleared her throat and spoke in a more sibyllic voice.
Mr. Nobbs, I see you surrounded by dusky ladies in a hot place. Looks a bit foreign to me. They're laughing and chatting with you. In fact, one of them's just handed you a drink.
None of them are shouting or anything, are they? Said Nobby, mystified.
Doesn't look like it, said Mrs. Cake, equally fascinated. They seem quite happy.
You can't see any magnets.
What are they?
Dunno, Nobby admitted. I bet you'd know 'em if you saw 'em.
Mrs. Cake, despite a certain rigidity of character, couldn't help but be aware of a drift in Nobby's speculation.
Some of the ladies look nubile, she hinted.
Oh, right,
said Nobby, his expression not changing in any way.
If you understand what I mean.
Right, yes, nubile, right.
Mrs. Cake gave up. Nobby counted out 10 pennies.
And that'll be soon, will it?
Said Nobby.
Oh, yes, I can't see very far for 10 pence.
Happy young ladies, mused Nobby. Nubile, too. Definitely something to think about.
After he'd gone, Mrs. Cake went back to her crystal and sneaked a whole $10 worth of precognition for her own curiosity and satisfaction, and laughed about it all afternoon.